Hey y'all, this episode of Hashtag AmWriting is, as always, proud to be sponsored by Author Accelerator, where you can start your own career as a book coach or get matched with the book coach you need to move forward. This is KJ, and I'm on round three of coaching right now because with all that's going on in the world, I found myself struggling to judge what I was doing, and I really needed some support to get it done at all. If you're interested, head over to authoraccelerator.com to learn more.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia, and this is Hashtag AmWriting, the weekly podcast about writing all the things, whether they be fiction, nonfiction, pitches, proposals, long pieces, short pieces. In short, this is, as I say almost every week, the podcast about finding a way to sit down and get your work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming book on preventing substance abuse in kids, The Addiction Inoculation. It'll be out in 2021.
And I'm Serena Bowen, the author of 30-odd romance novels. My latest one is called Sure Shot.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia, author of The Chicken Sisters, a novel coming out this summer, which you can pre-order in any indie or non-indie bookstore you can possibly come up with, and also the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, former columnist for the New York Times, and still a contributor there. So that's who we are, that's who why you should listen to us, and we had a plan today. We got something
we
to talk
about. We sure
do. Yeah. All right, lay it out.
Okay. Well, this continues our series about KJ's launch for her book and all the things that authors need to do when they have a book coming out. And in our first episode like this, we covered getting KJ's website together, which was super fun. And this time, we're going after the marketing talk that everybody needs for their book, like how to talk about your book and why people buy books, why they choose them, why they pull the trigger. And I have had a lot of experience, some of it not so great, with having to do this myself. I mean, you finish a book, right? It's like scaling a mountain. You make it to the top. Then you go through all of the post-production stuff with your editing and copy edits and proofreading and arcs, and it's quite the treadmill you're on here. But at some point, you really have to figure out how you're going to tell people about your book and what it is you want to say.
You probably already realized that you don't have a great answer because, you know, no matter how little you talked about the book personally as you were working on it, now that you're putting it out there, you're starting to talk about it. And, you know, the first thing people say to you is, so what's it about? And it's so hard not to flail in answer to that.
Right. There's that progress that happens, like the first couple times people ask, you've got this long winding, and then you finish with something like, well, it's kind of like that, but totally not like that at all. And then you get better and better and better at it the more you talk about the book. So, and if you've written a nonfiction proposal, at least you've had to sort of put it down in words a little bit. But that's just for nonfiction. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, yeah. It's hard. And the thing about this is you need it for every book and you need it under every circumstance. It does not matter that I'm trying to figure out how to launch a book into a global pandemic or, in fact, whether or not we'll be launching it at all, which does exist as a possibility. I still need this stuff. Like, this is, you know, this is always.
That's right. And I find that I get better at it, not with every book, sadly, but rather as the process of launching a book goes forward. By the time I get to the stage where I'm actually writing ad copy for Facebook ads, you have to have the most distilled kernel of what you're selling ready. And it's a scary process, you know, because once you've finished a book, it's quite final and you're not going to like rewrite it to make it more appealing right before you're done. So you're kind of stuck with yourself in some ways. And I have a method, and that's what we're going to do today, that I
yes.
call the Marketing Mojo page. And forgive the title of my little effort because I did not put a lot of thinking into it. But the Marketing Mojo page has a certain structure, and it needs to have that structure because every time I do another book, I don't need to reinvent the process. So it goes from the easiest things to the hardest things in order, and I find that that makes it work the best. So what I do is I open up a fresh Google Doc each time because, of course, I'm going to give other people access to this document, and those are the people that help me market, like my publicity person and my assistant, Natasha, who makes graphics and things like that. So at the top of the page, I start with things that other people have said. So Roman numeral number one is praise. What blurbs do we have about the book? What have other people said? And, you know, you might not have any blurbs or might not have a lot of blurbs, but you can even start with general things that people have said about your writing. And the reason we do this is not to get depressed that, you know, Gwyneth Paltrow hasn't blurbed my book or whatever, but rather people buy things because of what emotions they're expecting to feel. And that's really true. With fiction, it's especially true. Like, if you're picking up a thriller, you're looking for a certain emotional experience of that thriller, of being endangered and then being settled. And it's a roller coaster ride that is based in human emotion. And a romance, of course, is just playing a different tune on that piano. The emotional arc is going to be different. But even buyers of nonfiction are still doing this. Like Jess's book that's going to come out in 2021 is going to be full of cold, hard facts about addiction and our society. But people who pick that up are still expecting an emotional experience of reading it and how they're going to feel when they're reading it, even if Jess isn't going to market it that way, you know?
Yeah, it's actually been a part of a conversation we've been having. I had with my editor about, you know, the fact that this book, as just like Gift of Failure, is also highly sort of memoir-y. There's a lot of me in there. And so we had this conversation about, you know, do you let this tip over into the memoir sort of space, or do you continue to market it as sort of a more advice and how-to thing? And it's a really sensitive conversation because it really does help people have accurate expectations about what something is going to be.
Yeah, and of course, you're lucky in that you can play both of those fiddles. You can pick up the reader who is looking for a science-based, you know, bunch of facts, and the person who wants your story. So yeah. Anyway, getting blurbs about yourself is one way to, it's a shortcut to hearing to what emotions other people had. So one thing about it is they don't have to be fresh either. Like maybe it's a little too early in the process. You don't have those blurbs yet. You can still write, you know, things that people have written about your own writing. And this page is going to have two facets, which is you're going to use it when you need to whip out a quote for the bottom of your website or whatever, but also just for you to be thinking about the emotional process because you don't have any distance from your book. It's way too familiar to you, and that emotional journey that the reader is going to take might be sort of invisible to you now because you've been sitting with this story for so long. You know how what happens. So when you write down people's experiences of your own writing, you're remembering what it is you wanted to feel. And then remember, Jenny Nash has this wonderful trick, and she is, of course, the head of the Author Accelerator and our wonderful sponsor because she's so amazing. And she has people do this exercise before they write the book, where you write your own review. Like you write your own amazing review and you write your own bad review, and you sort of get the fear out onto the page about what people will think of the book. And if you don't have any blurb quotes of any kind, because this is your first thing you've ever written, you could start there and say, what is the good review that you expect people to give you? Because that is a clue to how you have internalized that experience.
That is a really good idea and not something, I mean, I have done Jenny's exercise and probably focused more on the bad review, but that's a great thing to say because if when you describe your work, regardless of whether it's fiction or nonfiction, if you're using words like comforting or challenging or, you know, intriguing or, you know, there's all kinds of places you can go with that. That's language that you're going to want in your marketing copy. And that's what we're trying to do here, right? Is we're trying to find those words that we're going to use when we write our shortest possible snippets to use in various places.
Right. And you're also excluding things too. Like the word edgy, for example, some people know that they write edgy fiction and some people write about bookstores and puppies, you know, and that's not edgy. So you just have to know which of those words really applies to you and which are going to just send the wrong message.
Right.
Okay. So after we write down some quotes, some praise, some of it real, some of it invented if necessary, then we're ready to move on to another easy assignment, which is to put down some quotes from the actual book. And these should be as short as possible. You're looking for lines from your own work that say something in a few words that is really indicative of the whole book. So I was just looking at one that I had done for a book called Heartland that that came out in November. And I wrote down a couple of short ones. And the first one is just like a super romancy kind of thing. And I wrote this line down. "We fell into a kiss the way I once fell off a dock into Lake Champlain, suddenly and without warning." It's not the most original line that's ever graced a romance novel, but it really says what this book is all about, which is an accidental sort of friends to lovers situation between two people who never expected to feel that way about each other. So it's just a line about a kiss, but it says something about the tropes that are going to be present in that book and the mood and tone of the book. And it even mentions a setting. So it's a pretty compact description. And another quote that I had written down from the book is, "Time heals all awkwardnesses," because the heroine is a bit socially awkward and she has lots of history and reasons why. And that quote is only 4 words long, but I still felt like it said something core about the story. So here we're moving on to writing quotes that are directly in the book, but we still haven't made ourselves write any sales copy yet, right?
Right. And I have done this too. And we have talked about doing this even as you write, especially in nonfiction. It's a little harder in fiction. If you're pulling something out as an amazing quote while you're writing it, you're probably going to delete it later. That's what Killing Your Darlings is all about. You probably can now at 30-odd books, but I think a lot of us might find that a little more challenging. But as you're writing nonfiction, you often can spot I think of it as spot the tweet. And I will add that if you change it slightly, it does not matter. This is not the kind of quote where, you know, you're going to footnote it and somebody's going to go back and say, well, but it didn't say she, it said, you know, Margaret.
Them.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
That doesn't matter. So yeah, I did.
That is so true.
Yeah. I did the same thing. I pulled quotes that I thought, I pulled "Who needs meditation when you have clean drawers?" because I have an organization guru who has tidied away a little too much from her past. I have, my personal favorite is, "It's hard to be calm when other people are so frustrating."
Yep. Keep going.
Yeah. Let's see. What else have I got? "Everybody thinks they get into reality TV for the money or the fame, but what they really want is to have everyone know that they're right, they're the best, their father was wrong all along. It's always something and it makes good TV, and that's my job." Now, that was ridiculously long, but I have shortened that into, and then the reality TV show here is called Food Wars. So I shortened that into something that more encapsulated the book, but doesn't really appear there, which is, it's called Food Wars. It starts out as Food Wars, but it ends up... how do I put it? It's called Food Wars, but it ends up as Family Wars every time.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really good quote, and it encapsulates a lot, but I think it's important to note, it's not really in the book, but somebody says something that is that. So, it's acceptable to pull out things that you think say something important and then mush them into something that is going to fit your marketing needs a little bit better.
Yes, it's totally. First of all, you can always misquote yourself. But secondly, you're doing the hard work of the distilling when you do that. So it's more than acceptable. It's God darn necessary. So pulling out your own quotes, like we've said, is easier than pulling out your own teeth or writing your own ad copy. And that's why it's number two on the list. So then,
actually, can I add one quick thing, Serena?
Yeah.
When I do this as well, I think about the fact that for just about every speaking engagement or interview I give in the next couple of years, it's very likely that one of these lines will end up in the introduction or the like a bio or an introduction. And so it ends up becoming a part of my speaking sort of pitch as well. So think about how you can also, as you're creating them, just have an eye to how these can all be repurposed as part of, you know, an introduction for someone who doesn't know anything about you or your book or what you do. And for me, it's been really helpful as I pivot from one topic to another to think of these as part of what will be my bio.
Yeah. I mean, this sheet that I pulled up to talk to you guys today is for a book, like I said, that came out in November. But I'm going to be opening this page so many times over the life cycle of this book. Like if I put this book on sale, you know, I'll go back and look at it to see what it was I want like to say about this book. If I do a reading when it comes out in German, you know, all of these things in the future life of the work, we're going to need them. And that's why this is like one of the most important things I do. So next on the list is a little bit specific to fiction the way I've written it. But what I like to do third is to list all the tropes and conflicts in the story before I'm ready to start writing ad copy. I like to see all of these things written out. So for this book, it was just it's a friends to lovers story. So I wrote that down. It's a love triangle early on.
I love the fact that you organize on your website by trope. I think that is just the coolest thing. It's for people that like certain tropes, it's great to be able to go straight to that idea, to that, you know, that thing they want to read.
Yeah, and if I didn't write romance, I wouldn't do it because there are other fiction readers who like to fool themselves that they don't really care about tropes. But
they do.
But everybody kind of does. And I have tropes that I dislike, like road trip stories never work for me. Like I'm not interested in being in a car that long with fictional people. So we all have our little buttons to push. But so in KJ's case, we would write down that it's a sort of a family.
Small town. I made the list. Small town. Family feud. Single mom, second chances. And then I sort of took some of that and I rounded it up and I ended up with the line like perfect for fans of small towns and second chances.
Yeah, exactly. And you have like returning home after a long absence.
Yep. And that's in here as a big city prodigal is what I called that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I condensed these. I took and I made a list of all those. And then I added, and this was from you. I mean, you came up with this. I added some of the funny tropes, like some of the funny things you might find in there. And I started to write lines like expect a small town feud, a big city prodigal, an all chicken recreation of Stephen King's Carrie and a manipulative reality TV host who really needs a donut.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Oh my gosh, that's so good.
That's the next step, the what to
okay,
expect.
Sorry, I didn't mean to jump ahead. But yeah,
that's okay.
And when I was trying to figure out, so a challenge for me that you don't face is that I am not as, you know, I know what tropes are and, you know, I know some of them, but I didn't, I know what I look for in a book. I know that if you put food in there or somebody who hates dogs who ends up loving dogs, which is like a truism of any romantic comedy anywhere that has a dog in it, those are things I'm there. Like you say that and I'm there. So I know my tropes, but I didn't really know what other people's tropes were. So I went into Amazon and looked at books that I felt like had some similar themes to mine and really similar stories, not similar themes, and looked at what some of their categorization was. And they actually have a sisters category, a small town category. And that helped me to pull out some of the things that people might want to know are in this book.
That's so smart. You guys are so smart. I'm so impressed.
So KJ took us to the next step.
But before we go on to the next step, I want to pause and try to think, you know, what in nonfiction, is there a version of this where you're not? And I think it kind of goes to what Jess was saying about which shelves you're going to find it on. In nonfiction, yeah. You might want to make a list of all of those possible shelves, even though you're only going to end up in one, because it's going to affect your marketing. So I, like Jess, have a nonfiction book that has a fair amount of memoir in it. And I mention that in the marketing of that. I actually say, it's not my story, but in a way that makes it pretty clear that you do hear my story. And I think you can do that there, or you can talk about if you answer certain questions, if you delve into some mysteries, if you've got some philosophy in there, if you've got some how-to in there. Those are some of the sort of trope forms that you find in nonfiction that people are interested in.
I also tried to think in terms of people who are really, really familiar with the genre. Like, one of the things I know about people in recovery is that if we're readers, we tend to read every single recovery memoir out there, and they're all very different. Some are just personal experience, and some are like Beautiful Boy are a mixture of, you know, research and memoir. And so I tried to think both in terms of what a general, you know, the general reader coming to this, whether that's a parent looking to, you know, to know more about childhood substance abuse, or someone who is a true devotee of the genre and what they might want to know about my book. Does this fall more on this side of the scale, or does this fall on that side of the scale? So I think that's really smart, is to sort of stand, even literally stand there in front of the section in the bookstore or in front of your bookshelf and look to see, is it more this than that? And how would you categorize it? I think that's a really useful exercise.
Yeah, even the most straight up nonfiction still has its own like mini tropes. Like, let's say you had a winter cookbook. Well, that winter cookbook would also be like cooking for a crowd, slow cooking, hot drinks, you know.
Right.
It would have just, yeah, the smaller categories inside it.
And finding those things is really important. And I think you don't even see how important it is until you spot them in your own reading. I mean, there just are certain sort of storylines that people have certain storylines or certain styles or certain things they're looking for. You know, in nonfiction, I'll buy almost anything that says slow cooker on it. So I think until you spot them for yourself, it's a little harder to create them for your work. But once you do see them, then you realize, oh my gosh, if I hadn't known, you know, that book had, you know, a professional organizer in it, I don't know that I would have picked it up. But I happen to love books about professional organizers who are not organized, probably for deep-seated psychological reasons that we're not going to go into here.
Cool. Well, then you've moved into the hard work of writing your What to Expect checklist. This can be for literally writing a teaser with what to expect. And in my ad copy, I do this. Like, I have ads that have a literal checklist with little check marks in front of them. But also, it's good ingredient matter for writing cover copy. So I'm looking at the one for Heartland, and I can see myself struggling to figure out the best way to phrase everything, because it says cute goats, and then it says naughty goats, and then it says a hot farmer. I guess I didn't need to rephrase that because that's all I said about him. one devastating little lie, one not so innocent person, or I left that one and went back to something else, a horrible roommate, an evil roommate, a not so carefree party boy, you know, just all the ways of describing and trying to fine tune how I want people to see those characters and imagine setting that scene. Family pressure.
Right. Mine looks the same way. It's got, it's like feuding sisters, seething sisters, you know, secret recipes, secret donuts, sort of getting more specific and in some ways less cliched there with the secret recipes and the feuding sisters trying to take it just to a, so throwing down the first level of description first and then trying to make it even more specific to your story.
Right. And then once we've got a checklist and we've figured out the right ways to write it, then that brings us down to taglines and cover copy. And maybe your cover copy is already written at this point, but you still need multiple taglines for how to introduce everything. Like, there are things you don't know about the youngest Shipley brother is one of the taglines for this book. And that tagline is for people who've already read the series.
Right.
And for people who haven't, I wrote a different tagline, an emotional friends to lovers romance full of risky secrets and late night sessions, lessons in seduction. And then I rewrote it to be less sexy and, you know, just ways of playing with your description for different audiences.
Yeah. And if you are traditionally published, you'll probably find that your editor / other people get involved in the taglines. So yeah, we had taglines. We had three generations, two chicken shacks, one recipe for disaster is the one that we ended up with. But there were All's Fair in Love, War in the Kitchen, which is also on some parts of, on some things. It's Easy to Play Chicken with Family Egging You On. I don't think we did anything with that one. Playing Chicken. No, what was it? Frying Chicken. Playing Chicken. Being Chicken. Some Things Run in the Family. I liked that one. It was a little too long for other people. So it's, yeah, there it is. Anyway, so I have a bunch too. And in fact, there are two different ones on the arc of the book, one on the front and one on the back.
Yeah, I loved hearing all of those. And you're right that it's a good team effort. When you get to this point and you've distilled it down this far, it's great to like show a friend or an editor all of these things and say, you know, which of these makes the most sense?
Well, and it's kind of funny because I would have sort of thought, I felt that some of these were a little cliched and might not have gone with them, but my publisher felt really strongly that they were the right kind of cliched. And that's not necessarily something that I would have known. So that's, you know, and I hope they're right. I firmly believe that they are.
Yeah, I totally think so, because you're getting a lot of trope in there and people really do pick up books based on tropes. If they didn't, KJ, there would be no more women's fiction books with beaches on the front of them.
And the loss to society would be dramatic. You know what? The tagline can also, it's also got a tone trope to it. I mean, all of those taglines are a little, you know, they're cute, quirky, comforting, which are all words that have been used to describe the Chicken Sisters. If your tagline was something more like, you know, she stepped to the edge of the cliff and never returned, that is not quite cute, quirky, right, and comforting, right? So your tagline has an emotional trope to it as well.
Exactly. It all goes to tone.
Do nonfiction? I guess in nonfiction, when we say tagline, it's almost, that's almost maybe more the subtitle.
Yeah, I think so. I absolutely. Subtitles are, you know, as we've talked in the past, subtitles are increasingly important because it allows me to have a title that may not be right on the nose, but then the subtitle is, here's what to expect from this book. And that's what makes it so hard because, you know, I think Gift of Failure had, oh gosh, we tried out We tried out close to 50 subtitles for that book, and it was a real struggle to find just the right one because you want to tell a potential buyer exactly what's in that book. And subtitles are an amazing place to do that.
Do you know what else is cool about subtitles?
What's
is that? They are very indexable at Amazon. Like the subtitle, cool. The subtitle matters more than even the book description in terms of searchability.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yeah. So you got to be a little careful with keywords in your subtitle.
I was thinking for SEO as well. That would be an important part of how people search for your book in general.
That might explain why I was recently in the Kindle store and came across a book that was called something. I don't remember the title of the book, but let us just say it was called, you know, Nantucket Romance, a perfectly soothing beach read for people who love. that was the subtitle. And I was like, okay. I thought that was taking it a little far, but. There it was right at the top of my Kindle page. So, and this was a pretty well-known British writer.
There's tons of abuse of subtitles on the Amazon platform for sure.
If we must abuse something, let it be the subtitles.
I guess, but I'm sure I could find you right now a book that has the subtitle, A Billionaire Cowboy's Baby Romance or something like that.
Yeah, I bet you could. And I might read that. I love billionaires. No. I kind of love cowboys. Babies, not so much. Okay. I would read it and then I'd be sad, two paragraphs in when it lived up to exactly the quality of writing that you would expect from the subtitle. So that's something to be careful about, too, I guess. All right. Where were we? We're in taglines and cover copy.
Yeah, because, we got there. And we got there by stepping through slightly easier tasks of, you know, what do people say about us and what lines can we pull from the book? And, you know, that just cushions the job of having to write about your own work.
Now you can just, if you just lump all this sort of into one paragraph and then start putting transitions into it. And then you can make it pretty.
Yep, absolutely.
This is also something to keep for my nonfiction purposes. This is something I kind of keep an eye on as I'm writing the book. If a sentence comes up that feels like a particularly well encapsulated sort of meaning of what the chapter is, or I feel like it's something that would be good for like a little Canva card to put on social media, I will make a little note of that so that I can keep track of those things so that when I get to the end, I don't have to go back through and look for them again. So that's something you can even be thinking about as you're writing the book in the first place.
Awesome.
Yep.
Now, cover copy. Cover copy is hard because it's really hard to strike that line between this is what you'll find in the book and this is how the book ends. this is the theme of the book, but also this is what the person is going to discover. You know, it's a tough balance.
Well, I think that not enough people realize that you can write a terrific cover copy for a book that really only describes the chapters 1 and 2 setup of the whole story.
That is so reassuring. That is actually what I have as cover copy, but it must be said that I did not have to write it. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not, so
it's
this is different than what you put in your cover letter when you're sending your book, you know, say that you're trying to get an agent or you're trying to find a publisher. Your synopsis in your cover letters.
So.
No? Okay.
No. I mean, in a query letter, you're still trying to just tease. You don't need to say how the book ends unless the agent asks you for a complete synopsis. Like if there's one, if she just always asks everyone for a complete synopsis, that's a part 2 plan. Or if she isn't sure you can pull off that amazing setup you just sent her. But you should feel always free to tease a publisher and to tease an agent with your killer setup. And do not worry about how that book ends or how many characters are in it.
Excellent.
If you have the ability to tease, you should just lean into it.
I love it. Yeah.
And it, when you look at books, if you look at the back of the book of books that you love, you can see that they don't, you know, they don't. There's often a question at the end that hints at where it's going, but that's all.
Yep.
Exactly. Will she be able to resolve her conflict with the love of her life? Will she decide to marry the man that she knew from 20 years ago?
Or better off? Or will that secret from his dark past destroy them before they can properly begin?
See, that's why you write the
good
back
stuff. Of the book ends with, copy ends with, when family secrets become public, the sisters must choose. Will they fight with each other or for their heritage?
There you go.
Oh, that's good. I like it.
I think I actually wrote that line. Other people wrote other lines, but I think I wrote that bit. There are some lines in here I definitely did not like.
Well, that was an incredible list. And of course, we will put this list up in the show notes so that people can have, you know, the truncated, the actual concise list. But we are actually coming to the end of our time. And I was wondering if we wanted to talk about what we have been reading. If you feel like we have covered this topic adequately.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. So, KJ, what have you been reading?
Oh, I just reread Gaudy Night by Dorothy Sayers because I needed something soothing. And I made a terrible, terrible, terrible discovery, which is that I own all of Dorothy Sayers' books in commercial paperback. What's the phrase for the...
Mass market?
Mass market paperback. And also, they're all easily 30 years old. And it's just, it was pain. It was hard to read it. The page is so yellow and the print is so tiny. And also, the cover kept falling off in my hand. So I think I might need to invest in some new ones. But it's been a while since I've read anything in mass market paperback. So that was kind of funny. Anyway,
I have one that I keep for sentimental purposes, and it's in like 8 different pieces, and them, you know, the it's completely fallen apart. There are chunks here and there. The cover doesn't stay on anymore. But yeah, it's those are actually harder if you're not buying them in airports and grocery stores anymore. They're harder to come across.
True.
And they're little. The font is so little in those books.
That was the painful realization, was that I probably haven't reread this in maybe 3 years. And the deterioration in what I can cope with was significant.
I have to say, I have gotten better. I every once in a while, I'll text you guys and say, I wonder when I'll actually learn that I can zoom my text so that when I'm writing, I don't have to squint. And I actually have started to do that. Like I sit down and I'll zoom my text out. And I don't know what my problem was. I would sit there and just squint at the page until I got a headache, not realizing that I'm pretty much 50 now. And it's time to consider that my eyes are deteriorating. Serena.
I am reading The Weight of Ink by Rachel Kadish.
Oh, yeah. I read that.
Did you? This was chosen by my... I left a book club behind in Manhattan 10 and a half years ago when I left, and I lost touch with them. And I just got a text 2 weeks ago. Book club is back. All the original 1995 members via Zoom. Here's your invite. And I was so tickled. And so I'm reading The Weight of Ink, all 500 pages of it, so I can hang out with these women again.
That's such a great idea. I'll also be really interested to hear what you think of that book.
I definitely had that book in my hot little hands. I can't remember what it is. Refresh my recollection, Serena.
I could tell you, but... I could even tell you what you thought about it because I remember us talking about it.
I didn't finish it, did I?
No, you didn't.
Yeah, okay. I didn't. Okay. Well, enough said. I mean, Jess did, and Serena is going to. So obviously this is a book with great appeal to some readers and less appeal to others, and that is fine. We can't all write for everyone. Okay.
It got fantastic reviews. I remember when it first came out, and there are things I really, really loved about it. I actually have to say, I am reading a book right now that I have been waiting to get in my hands for a couple of years now. There's a writer, Maria Konnikova, who writes for The New Yorker, and she decided that she wanted to, she has a PhD in psychology, and she wrote the book think like Sherlock Holmes, and she wrote a book called The Confidence Game about how we're drawn into con games and con people and how we get conned. And she started to write this book about becoming... She wanted to talk about poker as a metaphor for life, and she wanted to talk about poker from a psychological perspective instead of a mathematical perspective. And then, so she decided to get a teacher and try to play professional poker. And she got so good that she abandoned writing the book and went out and became a professional poker player. And the book sort of was on the back burner for a while. And she finally went back and finished it. And I have a galley in my hot little hands. And it comes out in June. And I have to say, oh my gosh, this book is so good. Like, Maria has this incredible way of writing, if you're familiar with her work from The New Yorker, she has this incredible way of writing about things like poker. I don't care about poker. I really, really don't care about poker, but she has made me care about poker, and she has drawn me into the mysteries and the allure and the thrall of poker. And I'm just loving this book. And it's called The Biggest Bluff. It's fantastic.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to that too.
Yeah, it's really good, and I'm so excited for everyone. It's the Biggest Bluff, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. But it was also really cool to watch her on her Instagram.
She left out the word poker. That's an SEO.
Like Monaco. It's a really good subtitle, How I Learned to Pay Attention, Master Myself, and Win. Because that makes it, it's not a book about poker. It's a book about... I love that mastering herself part. So there's definitely the self-helpy psychological part, and there's the winning part. And yeah, it's because she puts the word learned in there. It's definitely a progression. I love everything about the title and the subtitle of that book.
It sounds really good. I have been excited for it too.
Yep.
Well, how about a small personal update since we're all here in the end of March. It's the last week of March, everyone, and we are all tucked away in our houses and have not physically seen each other for days. And Serena brought me groceries because we weren't sure if one of our kids was sick, although they turned out probably not to be, but who knows, because there are no tests, because that's where we are. And I hope that you're listening to this from some date in the future when it's all just funny.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to that.
It was nice to see both of you on Zoom yesterday, which it appears, or whatever we used, it appears that that's how everyone is seeing everyone these days. So it's internet in our house. I was hopeful for this call because my husband's downstairs doing work stuff on a Zoom call. My son is on a call for a job interview, actually. And who knows what my other kid is doing? He's probably doing something online too. So this has been a real test of the nation's internet. It's been a little bit of an experiment, I think.
What we used was Jitsi, J-I-T-S-I, but I will note that the one thing I can successfully predict is going to come of this is that Zoom has become a verb. Or not a noun, but a noun. Yeah. And in the way that Kleenex and Zoogle and Zoogle. Xerox. In the way of Kleenex and
right.
Xerox. Zoom has just become the noun for online conference calls, no matter who you're using.
And there's been that whole new sort of genre of funny tweets about things, stupid things people do on Zoom calls, people pulling their pants down, forgetting. You know, like I have to worry when I go and do speaking events. I'm constantly thinking about that Naked Gun scene where he goes to the bathroom while he's wearing a microphone. And, you know, I have to worry about that all the time. But now we have all these new Zoom accidents of people doing all kinds of stuff with forgetting that they're actually on a conference call. Yeah. It's a weird time, people. It's a very weird time.
It is indeed. And I feel like we could do some things with it, and we probably will, but we're still just finding our feet.
We still have stickers, guys.
Yes, we still have stickers. We've been, I think it's been helpful to get to adjust my brain to this is the new normal instead of, oh my gosh, this is change. But now that this is the new normal, I think it's getting a little easier for me to focus.
Agreed. I sent out a top five this morning, and I didn't just send it to supporters. I sent it to everybody who subscribes to our email, and it was all about finding ways to restart if you if you perhaps have stopped. And we sent one last week also to everyone who subscribes to the email, which was Serena's very brilliant 5 things you could do if you are possibly feeling a little bit distracted from your normal work or maybe just a little bit anxious, which was a much better title than mine. So those are in our... The only way to find those is to go to amwriting.substack.com and join our email list. And if you do that, you'll be able to see those. And you can do that without signing up to provide any financial support, although we're always grateful to people who do, because both of those were public posts. So they're fairly easy to see. Or you can find them by going to amwritingpodcast.com and then clicking on support or subscribe, and then you'll end up in the Substack, which is where they are. It's been a little hard to figure out how to navigate all this, where we put stuff. So, working on it. Work in progress.
Speaking of figuring out how to navigate things, I have to get going because I have figured out, a local farm has figured out a way to distribute some of its stuff. And it's basically, you go to their farm and they set it down in a location and walk away. And then you grab it and pay for it separately. So I have to go pick up a whole bunch of stuff from a local farm.
Awesome. Jealous.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And until next week, everyone, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perilla. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.